All right, we are back for another workshop with Pacific Novel Project. I am your host, Jason Keith Peterson, and with me is Steve Childress. How's it going, Steve?
Hey, going well. I'm all about getting this workshop on.
All right, well, let's get to it then. I believe we're doing my story first.
Yes, Ghost of Silver Creek. Let's see, for this section of rewrites.
Set the scene for us.
All right. We are in the hotel in Silvertip, and Joshua is taking a bath and soaking the pain away from all the hard trail riding. And we meet the sheriff, Cooper Teague, after a good night's rest. So I guess we'll take off from there. I like the musings of Chalk and how the townspeople see Chalk and have had run-ins with him that didn't bode real well. I think it establishes some more of Chalk's freedom and personality and what makes him different than other steam horses fairly early. But also, I mean, we also get that too when he's first introduced, but this is like different setting, and it's a little more information. I also like how early Cleveland's mentioned, and also the mentioning of Chalk and Joshua having a reputation and being known, and on tagging on with that, the appearance of Mottled Gray became synonymous with Joshua's name. I like that. There's an established pattern of like his look. Let's see. Second paragraph down from the top of section 5, where he lay on a too soft bed, considering the layout of the town as he had seen it from the high ridges. I kind of thought a little, penny for his thoughts here. Nothing in depth, but a little dip under the water, maybe. Does it remind him of other places he's been with family, especially with families like the Brody clan? I don't know. I feel like I'm being left out. And down below the synonymous Mottled Gray, we have when he drifted off, he was thinking of the flashes in the mountains above town. I don't know. I kind of wanted a little bit more from that too, of like just access to Joshua. Like, I was wondering if like there are any like myths or legends with strange occurrences that he could draw on and then maybe dismiss as poppycock or horse feathers on account of being a non-believer or non-seer, which I wondered if that could be a possibility to add to like him not being able to see. Let's see, he can see Pa, but he can't see Ina, right?
No, he can see Ina.
He can see Ina, but not Pa. Okay.
Yes.
So yeah, I was kind of wondering if like, if the flash definitely was strange enough, if like it could, if it like could match up to like any like stories he'd hear, maybe he heard as a kid or, was privy to growing up about, strange occurrences in this fantastical realm as we have it. And this also in this Old West setting that, might kind of play into his being, oh, that's a bunch of hogwash kind of stuff. I don't know. Just thought I'd throw it out there. Then let's see, down on the next page toward the bottom. The sheriff seemed at ease, but his eyes were wary. Short and thick with large hands, Joshua guessed he'd be a beast in a fist fight. He had the eyes of a man who'd seen his share of hard times, et cetera, et cetera. Now I know Cooper Teague is there with another guy that had...
There's another guy eating in the place.
Oh, just another guy eating in the place. Okay. Yeah, because, I don't know, short and thick wasn't how I was picturing Teague. But But yeah, so I thought for a second there, I thought it was the other guy. Okay. Yeah, because I thought the other guy was sitting at the table with him, but there was just two people in the restaurant, not necessarily sitting together. Okay. Yeah, the portly man with thick mustache and sideburns, wearing a worn business suit, and the other an older man with a star pinned to his vest. Okay. Alrighty. I thought they were sitting at the same table. But anyway, okay, moving on.
All right. If I throw a better description of Tegan there, it might alleviate that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I like this whole scene here in the morning with Joshua coming downstairs and like Teague not even looking up as he's coming down the stairs, but like Joshua like being sure that Teague has noticed like every move that he's made. I do like that observation from Joshua, and I'm pretty sure that, you know, Joshua's correct on his assumption. And I also liked the whole, really, I liked this whole exchange between the two of them. I liked the dialogue. I liked this this piece of dialogue here on page 21, about quarter of the way down, about halfway down maybe. This place is a powder keg. It's just waiting for someone to ride in and set a match to the fuse. Now, in the original draft, this line was set out in front of like the sheriff's office, wasn't it?
No, I don't think this was in there.
No, it wasn't in there. Okay. For some reason I thought something similar. Yeah. Anyway, but I liked the line, cause it's kind of some good foreshadowing that, will also kind of prove to be the case. And I also get a better sense of Teague's kind of desperate position that he's in. That he's a legit lawman and stuck in the precarious position of politics and money between Cranston, Brody, what was that? The mayor, governor, I guess probably both.
All the above.
Yeah, all the above. So yeah, I got a better sense of his desperate situation and him being, you know, on the up and up, but also having to play by a set of rules that he doesn't entirely agree with. But that's kind of where I arrived at with him. And then let's see a little further down. Nothing set yet, but range disputes settled by a gun aren't unheard of. And I was wondering if Joshua ever had to quit a job due to violent robber barons, or if he ever went to work against one. With that sentiment, I found myself asking some questions. You know, I wanted to know more, a little bit more about Joshua's past there, as it relates to his current situation, and how it would inform him on his current situation from like things from his past. Let's see, a little further down. That creek runs off around this town and right through the heart of the double B. Ever since Silvertip went industrial, Silver Creek ain't fit to water gobbers, never mind cattle. I like this addition. It sets a new new expectation for why Cranston wants the lands the Nestors have. I also like the postulations brought forward about cattle killings not adding up that Cooper Teague talks about, and also some of his character observances of Cranston himself. I thought there was some good work here with dialogue, I thought, and I feel that it's setting up the rest of the story pretty good between these two guys, as we're kind of being introduced into this town, introduced to the townspeople. I mean, we've already met Cranston, we've already met Andy and Caroline. So, I mean, now it's like getting the bigger picture rolling now. And I think this whole scene does a pretty good job with that. Let's see, like this here, old man Brody's a forward thinking man, but he didn't consider the consequences of setting up mines to strip down those canyon walls. So it's like, I like this because it's it's short-sightedness. And I think it falls into a folly of the greedy, shit their own bed and they want to steal everyone else's stuff because they're not happy with having shit in their own bed.
Yeah, I knew you'd like that.
Yeah.
I type stuff like that. When I type stuff like that, I think, oh man, Steve's going to love this shit.
Yeah. And yeah, you know me. You know me. And I really liked this line here. Down on the next page, 23. Andy wore his entitlement like other men wore pants. I like that. It just, yeah. It really, really gets across like how comfortable dude is in his entitlement. And like, it's just, it's not even a thing for him. It's like, it's just like wearing pants. I liked that sentiment. And then let's see, a little further down, we get the writers coming in from the nesters. They're all rattled and jarred and going behind the bar getting booze and but there's one dude that is not really interested in the drink, but he's kind of staring Joshua down, maybe kind of not. And that's going to be Colt, right?
Yeah, that's Colt.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I... Okay. Cool. And that's what I got on this excerpt.
Yeah, that was kind of a short one since I was trying to get out of town and stuff.
Yeah, don't blame you, man. You had adventures to go on, man.
I'm going to make it up to you. I'm going to give you an avalanche of text for the next one.
All right, cool. That works.
To you and the listeners.
You have any questions for me?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Seems like your running theme this time was you want to be in Joshua's head more.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, I mean, not like, you know, nothing like totally like super in-depth, but kind of there were some moments that I was like, well, there's that, you know, this is significant. This is a significant mentioning of some of these things. And, you know, I just kind of wondered if it's significant enough for Joshua to have any particular feelings or musings, considering things being brought up. But anyway, yeah.
According to this, I added 1,614 line spaces. Well, I don't know why that's there. I don't know why I line space that, but anyway, apparently that's how much two lines across is.
Huh. Interesting.
All right. So, Hollywood Dreams. Last we left off, Tomb had found the dead body. They had started the investigation, trying to determine whether or not she was, you know, a singer, actress, wannabe actress, you know, pretty girl in Hollywood. They just assumed that she's doing something. Except waitressing. And I don't consider that. It just occurred to me. Aren't all the wannabes waitresses? Okay, so they're checking out the clubs. Well, he goes to check it. Tomb goes to check out the clubs, but he samples the product while he's checking them out. They come back to the police station, and that is where we pick up. I don't remember how long has it been. It's been a couple days? Or was it the next day?
At the police station?
Yeah, when they go to the police station. It's the next day, right?
It'd be the next day, yeah.
So Wilcox Avenue Police Station is where we start. So he's going in the police station. Tomb is going into the police station, encounters Larry Thompson, the reporter. We kind of briefly talked about that already. I was confused on who Larry Thompson was, but then he's from the beach. He reminded me he was from the beach, and it'd been a month or so since I read that piece, so I kind of forgot. Maybe just a quick two words, Larry Thompson, you know, that a-hole from whatever's there in my face again. But I don't think you need to go through the entire freaking thing like you did last time. Not that the last one was that long, but so he's, I just made this note that you have him fumbling, you have him asking questions, and he doesn't even have his notebook and his pencil or whatever out. As a former journalist, I'm telling you, that stuff's already in his hand. So he bugs Tomb. Tomb threatens to punch him in the face. Well, he gives him a little something. Tells him he thinks that he might be an actress or a singer. Although he just says actress or singer, which would allude to maybe somebody who's already known. And I don't think that's a big deal. It's just something I kind of noted, but I don't think it really matters. So that's when he tells him, that's when Tomb tells Thompson that if he gets in the way, he's going to punch him in the face. Here's your scoop. You get your scoop right here. Day clerk, Walter Prince. I don't really care who he is unless he's making another appearance, but that doesn't really matter either. That's just kind of my take on it, but giving him a name is cool. I was a little confused by one part of their conversation. I look over the message, but he up above asked if there were any messages, and Walter said no. Yeah, any messages for me, I ask, expecting to have some word from Edmonds. Nope, he says, without taking his attention from whatever hard-boiled fiction he's absorbed in today. Put that shit away. At least try to look busy, I say, looking over the message.
Oh, damn it. Yeah.
And then I didn't understand Walter's comment. I'll be busier than a new actress on an MGM casting couch. Does that just mean it's early yet and he's going to be busy in the afternoon?
Yes.
Get to work, I ask, and head down the hall. So say or said or something. And I just suggested deleting a few words here that I didn't think were necessary. So they have a quick conversation with Monty. Monty's here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Monty's here. Asked Tomb, how's it going with the songbird angle? He checked out a couple places, nothing checked out. They're going to hit a couple more places. Monty is talking about the watch dealers because they found that the fob of that, or they found that watch, that fobless watch on the girl. I kind of thought it was going to be the opposite way. I thought Tomb was going to check out the watch since we talked about his old art dealer buddy or whatever.
Oh, I'll get to that.
Okay. I just suggested a little rewrite here in this paragraph where they find Abbott. Abbott is the police captain. His door was closed because he was in a meeting or whatever when they first came in, but now they're leaving to follow leads, and Abbott's like, hey guys, calling him in his office. I seem to remember from the first draft him being a war vet. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you had him limping and stuff, so I thought maybe it'd be neat if you just add this part right here about him sitting behind his desk and maybe he's got his leg stretched out or something because...
Oh, yeah.
From that leg, because I know sometimes it's hard for me to... And then you just introduce, boom, right there. We got in just a few words, you got some of Abbott's background.
Cool.
And then the police books and framed pictures of police lost under his watch sit on shelves behind him. I didn't know how long you had that whole dead cops on the wall thing. Like maybe that was started from somebody before him or whatever. But I thought it'd be more interesting to have it be people under his watch. Like there's probably a wall somewhere in the station of fallen officers, I thought maybe like in his office, maybe it's guys who were under his watch, and that would just tell us more about Abbott.
For sure. Yeah.
Unless he's a dick who doesn't care, and those are just all pictures that were up there anyway before he got in there. And I think that's it. I think the content is pretty much the same. I just reworded some stuff.
Okay.
Kind of like, man, he's like, I kind of like, I think this is new, this whole look that he's got going with the curly mustache and the nice vest and kind of a Wyatt Earp look thing he's got going on. Right. That's kind of what I was picturing.
Nice.
Because he's got like a pocket watch, right? I don't know where those pocket watches clip onto. Somewhere on the vest?
Yes, there's usually like a little they pocket in those vests that they clip on like the, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering where the chain, like the end of the chain clips on. I've never paid attention to that before when watching stuff with people with pocket watches.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, sometimes they just have in their pocket, but sometimes they got the chain. What's the rumpus on the Jane Doe? He wants to know. Why did I delete that part? Oh, then the part under there that I suggested deleting is where I worked into the rewrite up top.
Ah.
I think. All right. So they let him know what they're doing, canvassing the movie studios and the bars and whatever, trying to look to see if she had a job. Yeah, that's where I comment that I thought that watch had the tomb. Tomb had the watch connection, but you're working toward that. And the sentence here, let's see. We sent a sketch artist over to get a likeness of the girl maid. I feel it's a bit more respectful of the dead. Abbott folds his hands and frowns. Have you considered she might be a pro skirt that Boone is going to miss? And who isn't going to be identified? I was just slightly confused there. I think when you say, and who isn't going to be identified, I'm assuming you mean because Boone's not going to show up and identify one of his whores.
Hmm. Yeah, could be.
I don't know. That was just the kind of like, I didn't, or is that a separate thought?
I see how that's
like, confused. You know, you thought she's not going to be identified. Pro skirt being a high class whore. Then let's transition to the morgue. Thought your change in Eunice, her name's still Eunice, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. I thought the change to Eunice was kind of funny. Made her like an attractive older lady, but then kept her Monsters, Inc. secretary paperwork lady voice.
She's a work in progress.
Hey, Kowalski. Nah, but I like that. It's like, oh, hey, here's this attractive, nicely dressed lady. Oh, my God. Your voice is killing me. So Monty has met Eunice for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
He's very polite. She likes him. And here comes Edmonds. And they take him. They check out the body. He verifies just some of the things that he noted on the beach in the beginning. He has found the cause of death, which is this hole in the back of her head. Yeah, I like this. Hey, a picture's being worth a bunch of words and all.
Yeah.
Oh my God, why have I lost this? Oh, here we go. Oh, here we go. Okay. All in time, I had a sketch artist come by and do a drawing. Oh, this is Edmund speaking. So they're asking for a photo of the deceased, even though Abbott said there's already one working on. So Edmund is describing the body to them. He has found a hole in the cranium over the ear, behind the ear. This entry point into the cranium is what killed her. I would like to know here more about the hole. Is it like pencil width? Is it like claw hammer width? Is it jagged? Is it like a, you know, clean, like somebody took one of those bolt things to her head. I think that goes a long way to what kind of assault it was, what was used to assault. They should, I feel like there should be a discussion of like, hey, what would do that?
Okay.
And if he's got a couple theories on, you know, what would make the kind of hole that is there. Tomb is upset that he didn't see that when he was on the beach. Although he plays it off like, well, yeah, I knew that there. Show me something I don't know is basically what he says.
Right.
So you got the cruiser headlights here. The cruiser. But the excuse of only having the cruiser headlights to illuminate the crime scene feels sufficient enough for me to bury it. You took the cruiser out in the new version?
Yes.
So unless you leave the, I know I suggested a rewrite that had the cruiser in it because I didn't realize the cruiser was gone. But yeah, so you either got to put the cruiser back in or take that line out.
True.
All right. And so they wrap up the autopsy report. He tells them you can pick Eunice's, the pictures of the girl up. In a way, it kind of makes more sense. You know, I don't actually have a full description of this girl. I'm assuming her face was kind of eaten off or something.
Could be.
Yeah. Anyway, it seems like a picture would be better, but if she's unread, because there's one part where you say what we think she looked like. So then I wondered, oh man, is her face all jacked up? And I don't think I ever get that description either on the beach or in here.
Okay.
So in that regard, it would totally make sense doing a drawing of the girl. Because, I mean, if you're flashing a girl around whose head's half eaten off, then I guess nobody's going to recognize her.
True.
Man, Monty's got a hard-on for this pocket watch.
Yes, he does.
Don't forget the pocket watch. All right, they have a little discussion about if this girl doesn't have anybody looking for her, they're probably not going to be able to identify her. They feel that the picture is a good likeness, the drawing, and they are going to talk. They discuss going to Silvermatic Studios to talk to Danny DeLuca, who we will discover is an old ally of and friend of Tomb's, who they have had a falling out with. And Danny is involved with the criminal element. Trip for biscuits. I don't know what that means, but I like it.
It's a meaningless pursuit. It's just like, okay, we'll do it, but it ain't gonna do shit.
A visit to Danny DeLuca's studio could be just another trip for biscuits. I don't know if I like that saying because, I mean, I kind of like biscuits. Trip for biscuits sounds pretty good.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I was like,
I like biscuits too, though.
I was like, oh, Steve pulled out another, Steve found another colloquialism that I haven't heard yet in this story.
Yeah. I'm trying to keep them parsed out. Not use them a bunch. And I'm trying to find ones that are interesting enough that, you know, yeah.
All right. And, it looks like that's where we end.
Cool.
So so is your next scene going to be, I see you got a couple notes down here. Is your next scene going to be Silvermatic?
I think so. I'm either going to do a watch dealer scene before Silvermatic. And I eventually do want to have Tomb take the watch to the art dealer. After they check out the watch dealers and like end up with nothing. I'm thinking about having Tomb like take it to the art dealer. Okay. At least he knows the art dealer has dealings and a history of having been and possibly at different times being in Europe. So, I mean, not that the pocket watch is mutually exclusive to Europe, but having a Nazi war eagle kind of, I don't know, may or may not.
Sure.
Yeah. So,
and he's probably got a lot of connections. So if he doesn't know, he probably knows somebody who knows.
Yes. At least be able to find somebody that that did the work, a, you know, craftsman, if you will.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So
where'd you come up with the name Silvermatic?
I don't remember now. it's been so long.
No, I like that. I like that name.
Right? So I did too.
It could be different things, because like, kind of brings the image to me. Like, isn't film like soaked in some kind of silver?
Oh,
phosphate something
like that.
And then the matic is kind of like automatic, or
yeah, I was kind of going like silver screen, and then I was like, well, silver matic. Yeah, I don't remember exactly how I came to that term, but it popped in my head, and I was like, oh.
All right. I think that's it for this time. I think it'll be a little bit longer next time. I mean, we don't want to go over an hour, but we don't want to go 20 minutes either. So, hey, if you're listening, thanks for joining us. And if you can find more of our back episodes on our website, which is patreon.com/Pacific Novel Project. And if you become a subscriber, we provide copies of the manuscripts that we review today. And we also have some book reviews, a book club, writing tips, and our 200-word short story. I almost said contest. It's not a contest yet, but we're hoping if we get people involved, it can become a contest. And we got some writing prompts and stuff. And we discuss those. The writing prompts are every other week. I think it's my turn to put one up. And at the end of the month, we just have a discussion. You know, we'll read a couple, see what people came up with, and we'll talk about our 200-word short stories and, you know, what we think about them and what we like about them. And it's just it's a good practice for trying to come up with a theme whilst practicing your word choice, because the shorter something is, the better your word choice has to be. That's all I got. Steve, you want to say anything, or you just want to hightail it out?
Oh, I was going to say, hey, come hang out with us, write stuff, have fun. And we can, you know, we can get together, talk it over.
Yeah. We like talking writing and books and themes and all of this stuff.
Indeed.
So, till next time.
Adios.
Later.